The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish. It is our summer audience facts special, so we're going to be going through all of our mailbag to find the best facts that you have sent in. Because right now, Dan, we're not in the office, are we?
No, we are on the road. We are doing our 10-year anniversary tour, Thunder Nerds. We've already done one in Bristol. We're on our way to Dublin to do our next one. And man, it is what amazing gigs.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. It's always amazing to do these shows because there are so many dorky, nerdy, geeky people out there. We absolutely love it. We feel like we're in our element. And the shows themselves have been so much fun. We've been doing quizzes. People have been sending in their best facts. We've met some incredible people, Dan.
Yeah, so we've set up for this tour the Hall of Fame, where we're inducting a new person who's appeared as one of the facts in our show. And we get them coming live on stage. But James, Anna, and Andy don't know who they are. I've been bringing them secretly in. We have had the descendant of Confucius on stage with us. We have had the asparamancer, the person who predicts all of the future political situations using asparagus, aka Mystic Veg. She was there in Bristol. We've had the co-writer of Fatberg, the musical. I have very exciting ones lined up for Dublin and for Glasgow, as well as Cardiff, London, and Manchester. I am so excited for these things. It's an amazing night.
Have you got anyone for Newcastle? You didn't mention Newcastle.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Newcastle might be the best.
Oh,
yeah,
wow. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, if you are in any of those aforementioned towns, then make sure you come to the show. There are still tickets available for all of them. I think there might be a London show that's sold out, but we did put on a new show. So the tickets are available and you can get them by going to nosuchthingsafish.com/live. Okay, Dan, we got a flight to get.
We do. So let's get onto it. You guys get your tickets. We'll see you there at the live show. Come say hi afterwards when we take photos with everyone. It's a great night. See you there. But for now, enjoy the audience fact show.
Hello and welcome to No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray. I'm here with Dan Shriver, James Harkin and Anna Tajinski. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with your favourite facts from the last 3 months. That's right, it's our summer audience fact special. You've been emailing your facts in to podcast@qi.com. We've caught a few of the very best ones, and we're going to be serving them back to you today. Here we go, starting with James.
Okay, well, the first one that I've got on my big pile of facts is from Glenn Matthews. And Glenn writes, to rival the Eiffel Tower, one suggestion for the Chicago World's Fair was a 200-person bungee.
Cool.
Oh,
on the same but extremely strong bungee rope?
No. All cool. Different bungee ropes. This is from a book called The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, which Glenn read. And he has lots of other amazing things that you could have instead of an Eiffel Tower to celebrate your city, in this case, Chicago.
Hang on. Tourists go every moment of every day to see the Eiffel Tower. If you were truly going to rival it, you would need 200 bungee jumpers doing that every second of the day.
What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. I just want to make sure.
You could do it like not every second, but you could do it every half an hour, say, right?
Yeah.
I remember staying in a hotel in Las Vegas and there was a bungee jump place on the top of the hotel, and just you would open your window in the morning. You're like, oh, what a beauty. And then there'd just be a
random guy sort of plummeting past your window.
If you checked in late at night and you didn't know that was happening, it's like, oh my God, someone's... Oh no, cancel it, never mind. He's going back up.
He must have changed his mind.
Tim, when we stayed in New Zealand on our first fish tour, there was the hotel was having a special
charity
thing.
That big tower in Auckland, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
I don't remember this.
Yeah, they do bungee off there as well.
It's all they do in New Zealand, isn't it? Having been. People bungee jump all the time. It's
really?
Everywhere. Yeah. Quite a lot in Australia, but New Zealand, it's just the only... New Zealand and Lord of the Rings tourism.
This is your weirdest stereotype. I've never heard
it's
that.
Not a stereotype. In New Zealand, there's a different legal thing, and it's to do with the insurance that you get for extreme sports. Okay. And I think the government might cover some of it, which means that it's much easier to set up an extreme sports thing in New Zealand than it is anywhere else in the world.
Wow.
I see. That's why. I thought they were just into it.
It's not a tax break. It's not tax deductible.
It's not tax break so much as you don't. It costs you less to do it. And
how would that work?
If you're constantly bungeeing, you don't pay any tax. That's right.
If you're sitting with your accountant, they say, God, you've really gone over the threshold this year. But good news, Mrs. Saunders, you can do 76 bungee jumps.
Your investments can go down and up and down and up. So what do you think we could have? Let's say, for instance, in London, we wanted a new tower to rival the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. They did actually come up with some ideas, didn't they? But what do you think would be a good thing to
I
have?
Guess the London Eye was meant to be that, right?
Kind of. That well, was... actually, the London Eye was supposed to be temporary, I think.
Okay, what about this? The London Ear.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Keep going.
Well, it's a huge ear.
Yeah.
Like a London Eye looks like a big eye, sort of. And you can, if you go in it, you can hear sounds from all over London.
Oh,
so
that's
nice. It's not an amazing view. It's an amazing sound.
And every day, those people from Gladiators uses one of their massive pugil sticks to clean it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Well, you'd want to be able to hear something, right? So maybe you need another ear set up over in Paris. So it's like one of the, you know, when you go to...
Like a telephone.
Kind of like a telephone, but in China, in the Summer Palace, I seem to remember that you would go to either end of the palace and they would have somehow that you would whisper to the wall and you could hear it.
Like you have
wall.
In playgrounds, you often have at other end of playgrounds, those things you talk into that never work.
There's also one of those at Grand Central Station in New York, Whispering Gallery. And also in St. Paul's
Cathedral.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jenga Tower. Everyone plays. Every Londoner gets to play, and you just have to insert a brick each, and then the person who causes
it's
to
removing
come out.
The brick.
That's not
really
quite how it works.
And they're spoiling every game of Jenga.
She's brought her own bricks.
We've been playing this game of Jenga for hours. I don't understand.
Great. Well, come on, James. What did they propose?
Sorry.
Was this Chicago?
This was for the World's Fair in Chicago.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. So J.B. McCumber thought you could get a massive tower, which is much bigger than the Eiffel Tower, 10 times the size of the Eiffel Tower, and you would put rails from the top going all the way to New York, Boston and Baltimore, which you can toboggan down to get home. So it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Hang on, you toboggan all the way from Chicago to one of these. That's going to be a long toboggan commute, isn't it?
That's the gradient is going to be quite unexciting, I would guess.
Yeah, it's a green run.
Oh, but it has to be enough. It has to be enough that you can toboggan.
You know when you're going a water slide and there's not enough water and there's not enough gradient and you just have to pull yourself along on your butt.
Like terrifying.
Like a dog with worms. You have to do that for 400 miles.
He said
in his proposal, as the cost of the tower and its slides is of secondary importance, I do not mention it here, but will furnish figures upon application.
Beautiful. Mm. Yeah.
Should I do another fact?
Yeah, let's have one.
This one is from Suleiman Ilyas Jarrett, and he said that he recently learned that since Biden dropped out of the presidential race, this will be the first US election since 1976 that doesn't have a Bush, a Clinton, or a Biden on the ticket.
Cool.
Including vice president.
What?
And he 76? Said, I even checked it myself because I didn't believe it, and then gave us a Wikipedia link, which admittedly I didn't check. But I thought it would be ballsy to put that link in there if it didn't prove his point. Mm.
Biden's not a great inclusion. Biden just is a normal president who
ran
for a term.
But he covers the last three, because he did vice president for two terms.
Two terms.
Oh, it includes VPs.
Yeah.
So Bush was a running mate of Reagan.
God, that's weird.
Do you want to hear a fact about presidential names? Because I thought I'd find one myself after having read this. Do you know what Grover Cleveland's nickname was?
Rover Cleveland.
Yeah?
Because he liked to go for a long walk. And
No, it's not that.
Okay. Drover Cleveland, because he would herd his sheep across America.
Any more rhymes of Grover you want to go for?
I'm working on it.
Should I tell you?
Yes.
Well, two. You can have two options. One is Big Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Isn't that a great nickname for
Big
Grover
Steve.
Cleveland?
Big Steve. Was Steve even a name then?
Well, believe it or not, it was Grover Cleveland's first name because Grover was another nickname that he had.
Oh.
Was it?
Yeah. But what's the nickname?
He was actually called Stephen.
Steve Cleveland.
But as in, I'm surprised that Steve, of course, Stephen has been a name forever and ever, but Steve, you don't get a lot of Steves popping up in Dickens or Saint in... Stephen.
Yeah, but he's American. It's a very American name.
It is now, but
Stephen,
again...
Stephen Fry has this whole thing that his American adventure, he so nearly moved to America when he was a kid, and he pictures this whole world where he was Steve Fry, because that's the name he would have undoubtedly had. It's such a...
I don't know. Edith Wharton and Henry James aren't mentioning many Steves, I don't think, but I don't know.
If you're called Steve and you're 150 years old, right in.
Okay, let's get through a few more facts.
Yeah, yeah.
Mandarin writes in, and she writes in with some nominative determinism.
Lovely.
Arthur Owen Blessett is a travelling Christian preacher who is known for carrying a cross through every nation in the world.
Lovely.
Oh,
every nation?
Every nation.
That's very
presumably
impressive.
Presumably all 193 of them.
He must have been annoyed when South Sudan was founded.
Yes, whenever there's a new one, he must be like, oh, for God's sake, picks up his cross.
Do we know if he takes a position on places like Taiwan or micronations? Yeah.
I don't know that.
Has he visited all those tiresome former oil rigs off the edge of the British coast? Yeah. Where some prat has said, oh, this is Steve Land.
Yeah. All the utopian failed areas.
I could just imagine Anna going to him going, so Arthur, bless it, have you been to Germany? And he's like, fuck! That would be the Blackadder. And we got one more bit of nominative determinism from Nathan Dwyer. He said that Scottish poet Ivor Cutler kept a set of ivory cutlery in his home.
That's fair enough. I mean,
probably a lot of people did, didn't they?
He's also a comedy writer.
Exactly.
Cutler, he's a poet, isn't he? Who writes comics?
I don't know anything about Ivor Cutler, but he sounds great.
A friend of the Beatles.
Okay. Okay.
Sounds like a euphemism, that.
Friend of the Beatles.
Friend of the Beatles. I don't know what for, but
he was in the Magical Mystery Tour, where he played a bus conductor called Buster Bloodvessel, which is where the pop star from Bad Manners gets his name.
I don't know about
We've those. Gone down a train that I have not been able to follow.
We're actually on a bus right now.
Do you guys remember when I visited the man with maybe the biggest collection of cutlery in private hands?
Yes, not only that, but this just shows where the hierarchy lay back in those days. You visited him because you did the original QI research and you picked up all the cutlery. And then once we were done with it, I had to schlep there to take it all back to him.
I didn't even know that we'd bothered returning it.
You wouldn't have, Andy. You were on to your next project.
Wow. That was the 11th series of QI because it was the K series.
Yes.
What series are we on now? 22 or 3? Yeah. So you've been carrying around that grudge for how many years?
I'm so glad I've got it off my chest.
The wording felt like you've practiced it in the mirror. It felt like this has been something you've been ready to get off your chest. I'm very excited. So you did that. You took his cutlery and then you just didn't think he might want this back?
No, I probably said something like, oh, someone sort this out.
Some fucking idiot. Yeah,
he would never have said that to a colleague, but I'd say, can we get one of the juniors to... James, give us another fact.
So Lowell Bender writes, if you haven't already covered this, I'd like you to know that some US banks have their own zip code.
Ah,
nice. That's cool, isn't it? Lots of buildings actually have their own zip codes in America. And in fact, the shoe floor of Saks on Fifth Avenue has its own zip code.
The one floor of a building.
One floor that sells shoes.
That's so interesting.
Ironic, because shoes are one item of clothing that rarely has zips.
There speaks a woman unacquainted with high fashion.
Yep.
Auntie and Dad are both wearing their knee-high boots today.
So many shoes have zips.
I mean, they're not most. I think most shoes would have laces.
Go into a leather shop and you'll see a lot of zips.
Do leather shoes have zips?
High heel, female high heel boots, boots.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's not as ironic as I led everyone to believe, because some shoes do have zips. What's something that never has zips? Hats. If it was a hat shop, it wouldn't
be. Oh, well, au contraire. Lifts off his top hat to show show. A fully zipped Trilby. The zip code of the shoe shop was created as a one-off partnership between Saks and USPS.
Hmm. I feel very mucky about that. I'm not sure about that. It's like when, sometimes London Underground stations will do a humorous collaboration with a big mega corp company, and they'll change the name of the station for the day to Bond, James Bond Street.
Oh, yeah.
Or something, if there's a James Bond film out to plug. I don't know if they've done that, but I just think it must be really confusing for people who are just trying to get around London. Maybe you're a tourist, maybe you're not familiar with it.
Do you think you turn up to Bond Street Station, which is on Bond Street, and you see it's called James Bond Street, you're like, oh, it must be somewhere else.
That's a bad example. That's fair enough.
Yeah. I just got back from Turkey, right, and I was at the immigration desk, handed my passport in, and the guy behind it, he looked at my passport, and he went up and he looked at me and he went, oh, Mr. Bond. And then he laughed and said, I bet you get that all the time. And I laughed going, yeah. And I was going, I've never had that in my life. And then I realized it's because my middle name is Craig. So I am Daniel Craig on my passport.
I actually get it quite regularly, I must say.
You get James Bond.
James Bond, because I'm called James.
You're called James.
I've definitely had it at least twice going through immigration in Russia, for instance.
Right.
And I've had it in a few other countries as
really?
Well.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's really weird.
That's so weird, because there are other famous Jameses.
Yeah, but I was carrying a revolver and having sex with a woman and drinking a martini at the time.
While we're on Russia and also kind of on trains, I read a thing which I wonder if you know the Russian word for train. Is it like Vox? How would you spell it?
Oh, Vaksal means Vaksal is train station.
Yeah, and the story goes that a bunch of Russian engineers came over to the UK.
Supposedly,
they went to they went to Vauxhall Tube, and they were like, this is so good, we'll just go back and name everything after it.
It was the Vauxhall Overground Station, I think, which was really ornate at the time. I don't know if it still is. I haven't been there for a while.
I wouldn't... If I had to reach for one word to describe Vauxhall, I would not describe it as ornate.
It's very functional.
Really? Because almost all train stations are quite beautiful. So Vauxhall hasn't managed to achieve that. But mind you, they're probably going for that Soviet aesthetic, which often isn't ornate.
Yes.
Although... In fairness, Russian train stations are pretty beautiful.
Are they?
Generally speaking, yeah. And the underground especially, like the undergrounds tend to be huge vaults with very ornate artwork and stuff on them.
Vauxhall Underground is the eighth wonder of the world. Oh, yeah.
Can I do one more?
Yeah.
Robbie Gorman writes about mushrooms. He's found a phrase on a website. If it smells spermatozoic, eat it. If not, you'll probably die.
All right.
Wait.
I need a reminder of what that smell is.
No, I don't think you do.
The deal? All mushrooms that smell like sperm are safe.
No, it's a very specific mushroom called the Miller. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone's told our colleague Anne Miller about this, but it can look very much like the deadly poisonous fool's funnel. And apparently the best way to tell whether your mushroom is a Miller or a poisonous fool's funnel is to sniff it. And in most polite books, it says it smells like raw dough. But actually, scientific places says it smells spermatozoic.
What if someone just wanked off on a fool's funnel?
Anna!
It's a great
it's a
point.
Good question.
It's a good question.
It's not worth the risk, I think.
It's not.
It's possible.
Wow. Well, imagine being told, like, God, we've got bad news about your weird fetish. You thought it was all innocent. You're out in the fields wanking on mushrooms. You've killed 50 people.
You're under arrest.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, it's now time for fact number two, and that is the facts that have been sent to Anna.
My headline fact this week is from Jeffrey Partica. He said, my fact is that every March, the US has a 50% increase in vasectomies so that men can spend their recovery time watching the men's college basketball tournament.
That's superb.
It is, and it seems to have been a very clever bit of PR from the vasectomy industry, because this is known as March Madness in America, and it's where...
The basketball, right, yes.
And it's where all college basketball teams play each other, and it's all done very intensively, like a knockout tournament, all happens in the same three-week space. So ideal for recovery time. I mean, actually, it only takes about 6 hours to recover from a vasectomy, so this is a lot of malingering men on there.
It could be a botched one.
Yeah. They always ask for the botched ones.
I was talking to the comedian John Bishop about vasectomies, and he had one, and he was telling me that on the day, because you're awake when you have it, right? But they go in, so they sort of cut open the ball sack, and you've got to go into each testicle with the tube. So doctor does the first one, and he's laying there, and he's sort of like, it's a very weird sensation. He's very aware of it. Gets the second testicle, and the doctor says, do you mind? We have a student doctor who's in today who would be interested to...
He's a big fan, Sean.
Can he keep one of your testicles? Is that all right? You won't be using it.
Yeah, so he says, yeah, the student doctor goes in and gives it a cut. And then all he hears next is, oh, no. And the doctor says, what have you done? And suddenly there's a bit of a crisis moment where he sees his testicle being lifted out and so on. And he's like, what is going on? It was a total botch job, and they managed to fix it. They sewed him up. So you can get botched even when you're famous comedians.
You can, especially when, I would have thought, if you go in as a student doctor and it's Judi Dench there who's vasectomy or performing, which I know is unlikely. But
so when they're advertising these vasectomies so you can watch basketball, do they say it'll give you a free shot?
Brilliant.
As in you can have sex without having kids. Yeah,
they should. Yeah. They advertise it as vast madness.
Why don't they call it basketball?
I'm sure that's in the press releases.
Okay. If not, you're welcome.
Yeah.
America.
Yeah. Why don't they get Keith Faz to do the address?
I mean, they might be already doing it.
I'm sure
not,
he is.
You're welcome.
Anyway, this guy sounds great, actually, Jeffrey. He said, I wanted to link this fact with information regarding frozen pea sales in America, because that's a solution often for men who don't have an ice pack. But there was no public information breakdown of monthly sales of frozen peas. So I've tendered a letter to the US Department of Agriculture about this deficiency. And he also says, I feel it should be noted that I left the mushy pea jokes to the professionals despite the low-hanging fruit. There we go.
Yeah, he didn't give us the low-hanging fruit jokes. So he jumped in with that one.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. That's great.
This is a great little fact from Robin. During World War II, the German city of Konstanz actually kept its lights on so that pilots flying overhead would think they were still over Switzerland. So clever.
Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Must just be close to the Swiss border.
It's Lake Konstanz.
Yeah.
I've been to Lake Konstanz.
Have you?
Yeah.
Nice. Did it have its lights on?
It was daytime. So they were cleverly...
So you just bombed it anyway.
Very
cool.
I think I was on the Swiss side of Lake Konstanz.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Mm. Interesting.
Funny you didn't bump into each other.
It was at different times.
You don't know that.
I do. We're not allowed to take holidays at the same time anymore.
No, that's true.
In case you're both killed at the same time.
Yeah.
No, that is really cool. And I can't remember why I was looking this up, but... in fact, it was one of my facts. It was about Royal Albert Hall. During the Blitz, or maybe it was in the First World War, but whatever it was, they would put over massive curtains over the top of it. And it was the same stuff as they would use to black it out whenever they showed movies. But they would put it all the way over the...
That's so cool.
Over the top of it, really? So that no lights would come out and would give anything away, or lights would shine off the glass.
So they usually use it to black out the insides. And they sort of turned it inside out, put the black out on top. Wow.
I thought you were going to say, wasn't that a fact that the roof of the Albert Hall isn't attached?
It was mostly that it was built in Manchester and then taken apart and then rebuilt on the...
Yeah,
but
it's just sitting on top.
It's just, yeah,
it's just loose. It's like an upturned bowl.
I mean, domes are just mental, aren't they? Like, what's the one in Florence? Is it Brunelleschi made the one in Florence, and we still don't know how he did it?
Ooh,
because it's got no It's got no structure holding it up. It basically holds itself up.
Is that the Duomo?
Duomo, maybe, yeah. I think it is, yeah.
I've been to the Duomo when I was tiny, but not at the same time.
But yeah, and we don't know how he did it. What we think is he built like the first circle, and then the next level sort of interlocked with the previous level of bricks. Mm-hmm. And then the next level interlocked with those. And then eventually it sort of holds itself up.
Like a jigsaw?
Like a jigsaw, kind of, yeah.
Interesting.
Like Lego, almost.
But we don't fully...
But we still don't know how he did it.
Do you think when if you're one of the builders doing it and you're like, this doesn't work? And he's like, no, it will.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what's your confidence as a builder when someone's handed you a blueprint of something that no other architect can make sense of?
Yeah, yeah. I can only imagine Brunelleschi was saying, just do it, mate. Just do it. Yeah, don't ask questions. Just take this cutlery where I tell you to take it.
I think it's amazing anything was built before about 1800.
I agree.
Big, anything substantial, just it's insane that they did that. Using what?
And built better, really. And built to last longer than bloody buildings today, am I right?
Yeah.
Stonehenge.
Yeah. Look at that. It's not that good a house. You wouldn't want to live in Stonehenge, would you?
The pyramids were the tallest building on our planet until something in America, right?
So the Eiffel Tower, I think.
No.
It's the Lincoln Cathedral.
Lincoln, UK.
Right.
Yeah.
Not in the States, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there was Lincoln Cathedral for 400 years.
And also, the Duomo, I think, was the biggest dome in the world until the Royal Albert Hall, I think.
Nice. Good fact.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. I think this is my favourite fact that came through. It's from Justice Goldstein Shirley. And it's this amazing thing that Bookland is a made-up country.
Bookland.
Where all books come from.
Did that preacher manage to get there? To
Arthur Blessett?
Yeah.
With his cross.
I don't know if Blessett has been there.
To me, this is not a good fact. This is a poor fact. Because it's just made-uppy.
No, because it's where all books come from.
Ah, but no. I've been to a place where books are printed. It wasn't in Buckland.
You went there as well, didn't you, Andy?
Not at the same time as Craig.
Basically, as they say, I've just learned a fact you all may enjoy. According to their barcodes, all published books come from a country called Bookland. And it's because when barcode numbers were being standardized in the 1980s, the first three digits of all barcodes of like products that you buy in shops, whatever, were assigned according to a country of origin. But books already had ISBN numbers, and so they didn't want to completely change the system for books. So they thought, we're just going to add a country onto the front of the ISBN numbers, a little bit added to the barcode. But to make things easy, we're just going to say all books are from the same country. And it's 978, which I'd never noticed. Every single book has the same first three letters at the start, numbers at the start.
We're next to a bookcase now.
We better check.
978.
Yep, this one's got a label on it.
How many should we do?
978.
Yeah, 978.
Mark Mason's book, 978. Katie Hickman's book, 978.
Yeah. Dan Schreiber's Impossible Things, 978. Out now. Out now.
Dan Schreiber's Impossible Things, 979.
Yeah, they've all got 978 at the
amazing.
Start.
Amazing.
All the numbers. It works. That's great. That's
anyway,
an amazing
and that's
fact.
Bookland. Yeah. Like, this is called Bookland.
That's like the awesome. Shoe shop having its own zip code. All books have their own country of origin.
Yeah.
Non-existent country.
Yeah,
love that. Is.
Do you want me to do more?
Yes.
Yeah.
Great, I will. Benjamin Kurtz. 1986 movie, The Manhattan Project. Has anyone seen it?
Okay.
No. Nope.
It's about a kid
really
who makes...
Bombed.
Who? Nice. Nice. It is.
It was fine, man.
It was quick. It wasn't funny, but it was quick.
That was a Richard Feynman joke.
Oh, was it?
Oh, wow, Dan, that was good. That was highbrow.
Yeah.
It's about a kid who makes a nuclear bomb and the prop designer took things a bit too far and designed a bomb that might actually have worked.
Is that based on a real story? Because there was a kid who made a bomb, wasn't there? Do you remember?
Yeah, there was. I think was that not more recently?
Was he a Boy Scout? I think it was about then.
And it was in his shed or something.
Yeah.
And they had to take his shed and bury it in the middle of the desert.
That's right.
Wow.
It doesn't claim so, but maybe they did plagiarize the story.
How do they know it might have worked?
Well, this is the thing. It said it would have worked, but it was minus the plutonium sphere. And then I went down such a rabbit hole about how you make atomic bombs. And basically, the plutonium sphere is the center, which is quite important.
It is the main bit, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is the explosives around it. But I ended up looking up.
But
still, you know, you've put all the explosives together. All you need to do is chuck a plutonium.
Exactly. Yeah. If you watch the Mission Impossible films, those things are 10 a penny. They're constantly being traded across the world.
I love the idea, though, of prop makers doing it so well that the thing, like, can you imagine if, like, Michael J. Fox actually disappeared when he hit 88 in the DeLorean? Barry!
Have you guys heard of the Demon Core?
No.
It's kind of cool. So I looked up plutonium sphere, and this is the only thing that comes up. It was the third bomb. So it was meant to be the bombs that obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Americans had a third one ready to go if the Japanese didn't surrender. They nicknamed it Rufus, but it was renamed the Demon Core. But basically, when Japan surrendered, they were like, well, we've got this spare plutonium core now. Let's do loads of experiments with it. And these scientists just went nuts with it, trying to experiment with how much radiation it took to kill you and, you know, where you reach the critical point where there's a radiation explosion. But it kept on going wrong, understandably. So there was a scientist called Henry Daglian in August 1945 who went to the lab after dinner, which sounds a lot like he had a lot to drink, stumbled back to the lab, built all these bricks around the plutonium core made of tungsten carbide, which apparently makes it more and more radioactive. And he got to the exact moment where he knew if he added one more brick, it would suddenly have this radiation explosion.
This is your version of Jenga as well, isn't it? Just going to add one more brick.
It's the most dangerous Jenga game in the world.
Wow.
For bad kids.
And did he add it?
No, what he did was he thought, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the bricks away now because I don't want to kill myself. Mm. But he went to take one brick away and he dropped it on the core and there was a big flash of radiation. It was only for a split second and he went and grabbed it and pushed it off. But that was enough and within 20 days he was dead.
Whoa!
Yeah. It's the scariest thing, isn't it? Because you think, oh, that tingled a bit. It's probably fine. But it's actually not if it's a plutonium core.
Mm. Good to know.
Yeah.
Public service.
Great, anyway, thanks. That was just the rabbit hole I went down.
Wow.
That's brilliant.
Okay, let's have one last one from Sam Bromley, who says, during a bout of hiccups today, I did some Googling and found out that some proven remedies for hiccups include finger in the rectum or a fist. I'm afraid there's nothing more to that.
The thing is, like, if a finger in the rectum works, why go full fist? Or did it start off with an arm and then they thought, actually, just the fist will work? Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh, actually, just a few fingers will work.
Actually, maybe just give it 10 minutes and it will go naturally.
Certainly would be a shock. You know, you're told to shock someone.
I think,
if you start hiccuping and someone puts the fist up your rectum, then that will be a shot.
Yeah. And it's worth two in the bush, I hear. Is the fist in the...
A fist up the arse is worth two in the bush.
Oh, Andy.
Sorry. Jesus Christ.
Sorry.
I bought my wife something called Hiccaway.
What?
Hiccaway.
Right.
Anti-hiccup thing.
What shape is it?
It's a mechanical arm that just...
It's not that.
What is it?
It's a thing that you drink from, but it's like a straw. And it's supposed to be proven to get rid of hiccups because my wife suffers from hiccups.
So James, I'm here to tell you that you have given your wife the fist, whether you know it or not.
Okay. Oh.
That's what the fist is. So a finger in the rectum study, and he has cited studies which actually show a finger up the rectum works, but the fist is something completely different, F-I-S-S-T, and it stands for forced inspiratory suction and swallow tool, and it is the Hiccaway.
Oh.
So you fisted your wife without even knowing it.
Stop it, Anna. This is the bluest
just facts. It's just facts.
So what is it?
It's a straw that's particularly hard to suck, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why does the finger work, out of curiosity?
Surprise.
No, because if I'm doing it to me, that's not a surprise.
I think it'll still be a surprise.
I'll be surprised.
It's not a surprise to yourself. It's like trying to tickle yourself. You can't tickle yourself.
I believe if you're schizophrenic, you can shock yourself with a finger up your own anus.
Right, there we go.
Is it vagus nerve stuff?
I actually didn't read the study. It's a digital rectal massage that you give yourself, but I felt like I'd gone deep enough.
The only thing I remember about putting a finger at the bottom is it's the way to get a dog to stop biting you.
Oh, the dog's bottom or your own?
the dog's like, that's disgusting. We're not biting this guy.
Thank God you clarified, though, Adam. There will be someone out there who will remember that little nugget one day. He died being bitten by a dog with his finger up his ass. We can't
quite work out.
Okay, it's time for facts.
number three, and that is Dan.
Yep, so we've been sent in a fact here by John Waldrop from 1934 to 1947, and then from 1951 till his death in 1954, the mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, was Harry Bowles.
Very good.
Yeah, I remember mentioning him years ago on the show, but I don't think it made it to an edit in the end.
He's called Harry.
He's called Harry Bowles, B-A-A-L-S. Mm-hmm. The pronunciation is that because he was once on a radio show with a guy called Bob Chase, who wasn't quite sure what to say in the moment. And so he pronounced the mayor's name Bales. So he said, Mayor Bales is with us. Oh. And he called him on it and he said, son, this is your mayor. I pronounce my name Bowles. So he was very into that. But yeah, he seemed to be quite an interesting character. He did a lot of stuff for the city. He sort of helped to build underground sewage systems. He launched lots of city departments, lowered the city tax rates. A liked guy by all accounts. I looked him up on eBay and you can find...
you can buy him for $12.99.
Yeah, he's available now. No, there's a lot of the old paraphernalia that you can buy from his, I guess, election time and just general stuff. And I can't tell which ones are genuine or not, but it's you know, on the badges, it will say stuff like, I'm proud of my Harry Bowles,
Cool.
So they obviously leaned into it. And apparently one of the most stolen street signs that you can get in the States is Harry Bowles Drive. And that's constantly being...
Wow.
Yeah. So they had to rename it to H.W. Bowles Drive to avoid that.
Like the Bowles bit is kind of part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so yeah, thank you very much to John Waldrop. Here's an interesting one that we got sent in. Someone was saying that I love the show.
Oh, that's great.
Yep.
Nice.
Move on to the next one, maybe.
Yeah, so this is from Jessica Ackerman. I love the show. In episode 538, Anna's fact is that there are only two colors of cat. Mm. As a cat lover, I love the conversation. And I have a rad fact about cat allergies to share. Mm. We can use chickens to make cats less allergenic. Okay, so this is how it's done. The protein, FeLD1, is responsible for around 90% of cat allergies in humans. The protein is found in cat saliva. Scientists have found that chickens raised in the proximity to cats develop an antibody to FeLD1 called IgY. That is passed into the yolk. If you feed a cat egg yolks from the cat-exposed chickens, the IgY antibody will cause the cat's body to produce less of the FeLD1 protein, thereby lessening the allergen that most humans react to.
So, sorry, keep a chicken near your cat,
yep,
then feed the cat the eggs
of
that the chicken has laid.
Yes.
And the cat will produce less of the stuff that...
How do I convince my cat to eat this egg? Do I mix it in with some Evian?
Yeah. It's exactly that. You mix it into cat food. There's also companies now. There's one called Purina that sells a cat food that I believe has it mixed into it already. But the DIY solution, as Jessica points out, is you mix it into the food of your cat. We can't eat the eggs and sort it out on our side. It has to be the cat's.
Mm. Because then the cat would have to eat you.
Yes.
That's a great fact.
Yeah, that's very cool.
That's very cool. Well, this is quite similar, actually. This is from Zoe Keane. She writes that Dr. Anthony Waddle has created budget frog saunas. And this could be amazing. Oh,
I hate it because I always spend so much money on my frog saunas. About time someone hit the lower end of the market.
So there are frogs that are being wiped out by a fungal infection called chytrid or citrid, C-H-Y-T-R-I-D.
It's a really big problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there are all these rare frogs in places like Hawaii, which are just dying because they're dying by the thousand because they're just getting these fungal infections.
Yeah, so it's thought to have caused 90 species to go extinct, decline of a further 500 species. It's a big, big problem. And the idea is that once this fungus reaches an environment where the frogs are living, it's pretty much impossible to save them. That's what it's been like up until now, until Dr. Anthony Waddle comes in with his frog saunas. Because what he's worked out is that heat treatment will prevent frogs from croaking, as Zoe has written. So they set up a bunch of experiments where they put frogs into a sauna-like condition. It was very heated. They made it so that it was fun for them to be in there, and they noticed that
how did they make it fun?
Well, I guess
they said you can pour the water on the coals. Yeah.
Lovely fluffy towels to wear. They make sure there's a good storage unit for all their gold and watches.
Yes.
And all that.
Relaxing music.
Yeah, sorry.
You don't go to budget saunas, do you, Dan?
Where's the gold locker? Sorry.
Isn't that what you have to do? You got to take off all the jewellery.
Oh, like your wedding ring and things.
Yeah. I
mean, it sounded like you were turning up with a huge chain.
Yeah, it did. Also, Dan, you shouldn't really take off your wedding ring when you go into the sauna. I know.
Shouldn't you? I don't know, because I don't really use one. It's going to not burn through your finger.
It sends a message, doesn't it?
So, okay, so basically the idea is that they created what are effectively saunas for the frogs to be in, and they discovered that the frogs seem to have an immunity once they are in this heated area, and that the fungus can't handle the heat and dies off.
Is it if they've caught it, they can be saved? Or is it like sort of, do you know what I mean? As in, do they have to have already contracted the fungus?
Yeah.
Or maybe that builds up
a resistance. It must be, because if you just put a bunch of uninfected frogs in saunas, they're also not going to get it, but also you've got a bunch of uninfected frogs stuck in a sauna forever.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So hang on. So in the lab, they allowed infected frogs the option of spending time in the warm environment. They sprang at the chance to use the saunas. The fungus could not handle the heat and the frogs recovered. A control group without sauna access stayed infected.
Right.
So what they're trying to work out now is, how do we create natural saunas for these frogs in
global
these...
Global warming!
There we go. It's naturally going to happen. It's going to be... We're all going to die except the frogs.
Well, it's fair enough that they should have a turn.
Do you know that fungi are 2 times more deadly than they were in 1990?
Why?
Because people keep spaffing off onto them.
It's so rude.
It's an epidemic.
It is. It's due to a substance that we're putting on them, but it's fungicides, basically.
James, sorry, really? I'd never do this, but just a quick request for the edit. Can you just remove all the earlier mentions that Anna made of that, so it comes absolutely out of nowhere?
Yeah, we're using more fungicides than ever, and like if you use too many antibiotics, you get antibiotic-resistant bacteria. You can get more antifungal resistant, so they're much more dangerous than they were 30 years ago.
I've had a thought about this fact that we got in. Was it from Zoe about the frog sauna one?
Yeah,
you know, it's nice because now we can update a saying, can't we? There's that classic saying, you know, if you put a frog in warm water and raise the temperature, how long before it screams or whatever, or how long before it, you know, panics and dumps out.
It's a catchy
out.
One.
So it's saying?
No, but you know,
it's
a frog
saying, is it?
It's like, a parable of a
is
frog.
Is this like count your chickens that I didn't know? Is this another?
There's a frog in a bath and you raise the temperature and, you know, how long before it actually realises that it's dangerous and tries to jump out?
It's not a raising, saying.
No, but it's a bit.
It's a thought. It's a thought experiment.
Use it in, like, I'm at your house. When would you say that
to me? For instance, oh, Dan, you know what? These tax rises, they're happening, but they're happening quite slowly. And so people don't complain about them. It's like a frog being in a pot of water and it getting warmer and warmer and warmer, and they never jump out because they never realize it's gotten too hot.
Thank you. Exactly
it's
like that.
Very political option. Not the one I would have gone for.
That's basically the premise. So this is an update because you've got a frog in a sauna and it's nice. It was more of a slam dunk in my head when I was planning this.
More than that, really.
Let's move on to Oliver Titcomb, who says, my fact this week is that Canadian police procedural Due South was set in Chicago, but filmed in Toronto. In one episode, the characters crossed the border to reach Toronto. This scene was filmed in Chicago.
Okay. No.
It's very nice.
Yeah.
Is that for a funny joke? Of the directors.
I know. I looked into it slightly, and that's kind of one of those IMDb factoids that you don't get much more on. Maybe it's out there.
I never watched Due South, but I always assumed it was Canadian, all of it.
It was set in Chicago. Yeah.
Which is not in Canada.
I know, right?
So how did you assume it was Canadian? You recognised all the sites of Toronto. Why do they keep referring to Chicago when there's the famous...
CN Towers right there. Yeah. In the middle.
So wait, hang on. Where was it? It was filmed in Chicago.
It was filmed in Chicago. No, filmed in Toronto.
Thank you.
I think, I actually didn't look into this bit, but I'm going to assume that it's a Canadian police show that is based about a Chicago police station.
How? In what sense is it a Canadian police show, except that it's filmed in Toronto?
The show follows the adventures of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. What are they doing in Chicago?
What is going on then?
Why are they
Wait a minute. Who first came to Chicago on the trail of the killers of his father.
I see.
So he's a Mountie who is like a fish out of water or a frog out of sauna.
Right.
He goes to Chicago. I think this would have been helped if any of us had seen Due South.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, Oliver's email was a bit longer and I cropped it to just that one paragraph. Okay. So he actually did explain a little more, but I thought...
Okay.
I'm sending it to Dan. I've just got to include the first para.
Yeah, yeah. That's
the show's format looked at the stereotypical differences between Canadian and American culture at the time.
That sounds quite good.
Created by Paul Haggis.
Great name.
I want to see the show where he goes to Scotland.
Yeah.
Okay, another fact from Sarah Ellis. And I'll do this as a quiz question because I think it's sort of presented like that.
Yeah.
In parts of Australia, there will be 2 minutes in a day that last for a minute and a half each. Why?
So I've seen the answer.
Okay,
came into the inbox. So yes. I'm going to rule myself out. Or I'll try and trick these others, actually.
Okay. Go on, then.
I'll say it's because Australia is so big, they have to stretch the minute. So
that's a good idea, isn't that? Lovely. Yeah, I'm going to go for that.
Yeah. Can I ask some follow-up questions?
Absolutely, yeah.
Great. Is it just on one particular day or is it every day?
It's every day.
Right.
Can you say it one more time?
Yeah. So in parts of Australia, there will be 2 minutes in a day. And those 2 minutes last for a minute and a half each.
Okay, okay. Do we lose the other minute? Because the number of minutes in a day presumably is the same as anywhere else.
Hmm.
So we've got an extra half minute from each of those. Have we lost that minute somewhere else?
Yes.
Hmm. Ah, okay. So they've decided to do away with one of the minutes of the day.
Which minute would you lose? Ooh, what a question.
I reckon I'd lose the minute of you talking about people spunking over mushrooms. Why would you lose a minute? Well, logically, you'd say the first or last minute would be a good one to lose. Maybe the confusion of 0:00,
mm-hmm.
like as in midnight. Mm-hmm, is it one day or is it the next day?
You're bang on.
Is it really?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. It's but where in Australia? This is a bit too hard to get.
Scott's podcast.
This is too hard to get.
We can get it.
You can't. Well, it's a bit misleading.
How many places in Australia, rather?
What's a bit?
Sydney or Melbourne?
Have we heard of this place?
It's not a place. Let's say it's
the exact centre.
It's an institution. Help me out, Andy.
Oh, is it Space Agency?
GPS.
Think like they're related to that. Who invented GPS? Who owned GPS?
NASA.
For a while? And the
Space Force.
And the American, they've got big guns.
Army.
The Army.
Wait a minute, is he still tricking us?
Slightly.
I can't remember. I think, is it the Army?
It's the Royal Australian Navy.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So the explanation Sarah gives is that the Royal Australian Navy uses a 24-hour clock as opposed to 12-hour time. 24-hour time starts at 0:00. And it goes until 23:59, as we all know, then resets. Now, for some reason, they just don't like the 0:00. So what they do is they make the minute 23:59 last a minute and a half. And then when it flicks over to 0:01, and that lasts for a minute and a half. And
I
then you
love
move back
that.
On.
Wouldn't it be amazing if you could lose? I was just thinking about the minute of the day that I would lose. And getting out of bed is the worst moment of the day, right?
Uh-huh.
If you could lose the minute between when you're lying down and when you're standing up, so you could just be like lying down and be like, okay, fine, can I skip ahead a minute now? And then you're standing up.
A great premise for something, a story or a film or something. You have a button that you press and it just, I think
just
that's a great
that
idea.
Minute. Yeah. Thanks, Andy. And this is a published novelist here. Okay. You're saying that?
Someone sent
978? 978?
978.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, it's time for the final facts of the show, and those are my ones. So get ready, guys, because these are the really good ones, right? These are the the creme de la creme. So here is a great one. This is from Derek Dayman, and he writes, I'm a train operator on the New York City subway. And I noticed the most bizarre Shakespearean coincidence within the system that I want to share with you. This is great. The fact is, the Romeo train goes through the Montague Tunnel and the Juliet comes close but never gets to join it. Mm. Okay, this is insane. And I'm pretty sure this is a Derek-generated fact. I think he's the first person to notice this, which is so cool.
Okay.
So there are all these subway tunnels connecting Manhattan and Brooklyn, right?
One of them is called the Montague Tunnel.
Presumably not named after the family in Romeo and Juliet.
No, it gets its name from the street that it runs underneath once it reaches Brooklyn, which is Montague Street. So in New York, the subway lines are, they just have a letter or a number. You know, the A train, the B train.
It's not like Alpha and Beta?
Well, they do the phonetic alphabet. So train crews on the R train call themselves Romeos, and train crews on the J train call themselves Juliets. Mm. And the R train goes through the Montague Tunnel. There are tracks which would allow the J and Z trains to also use the Montague Tunnel, but they aren't used in passenger service. They both terminate just before the entrance to the tunnel. So Juliet never gets to join Romeo through the Montague Tunnel. I just think that's great.
That's
brilliant.
So good.
Brilliant.
Well done.
Do you want to hear, this is a great, this is an Australian one. We're going to Australia soon.
Yeah. Okay.
This might be helpful. From Will Davies from Emerald Beach, New South Wales. Familiar to any of them?
No, I heard
it's,
that.
Yeah, it's by the coast, I think.
I'll do this one as a riddle as well, actually. The third largest airline in Australia does not charge its passengers to fly.
What?
Is it?
So it's going to be animals that it's...
Yeah.
Or some sort of freight or military.
Flying doctors.
Not freight, it's not... James has got it.
Flying doctors.
Flying doctors. Third largest by fleet size.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose that's not total passenger capacity, but like number of planes you've got, because they're mostly quite small planes. So yeah, it's the flying doctors, who I don't think we've ever spoken about.
No. How does what are they?
Well, they're...
Outback doctors,
as it sounds. As it sounds.
As it sends. But is it, as in, what do you, is well, it like if you call an ambulance in the outback or you've been hit by a kangaroo, then you call and a doctor has to get to you?
Yeah. Or something even less stereotypical than that.
Oh, no, one of the cogs went in my eye for my hat.
Uluru fell on me. Yeah, that kind of... Yeah.
I guess because you'd normally have just a paramedic go and then take them to...
Yeah, but some of these places are so remote.
You're distant.
And they've got very low, but small populations. And so you just need... If you need a doctor within a couple of hours,
the reason I actually knew about it is probably 10 years before Due South came out, there was a TV show called The Flying Doctors, which was, I didn't really watch it, but I knew that it was about this.
Yeah,
I used to watch it back home. Yeah, it was a sort of staple of, you know, along with Home and Away and all that.
Okay, here's a bonus quiz. This is something, because I was reading a bit about The Flying Doctors.
Yeah,
in them. So they, if they're landing in the dark, places they're flying to are not equipped with airports, most of them, right?
Yeah. No.
So that what they want is proper sort of flares or electric lights on the runway to clearly mark out where they have to land at night. So if you are landing somewhere which doesn't have those lights, what is the best alternative that the flying doctors like to use?
Pumpkins.
Fireflies.
Not bad.
Bioluminescence.
It's you have to breed some phosphorescent shrimp and you chuck them out of the tanks. You just throw the aquariums. Every community under 20 people in Australia has millions of shrimps on standby in case someone breaks their leg. No, it's
phones.
You are setting,
hold your phone
that's
up.
That's a really nice idea. You are setting you're setting light to something. What does every house have?
Netflix.
A washing machine.
Gold safe.
Evian.
It's dunny roll.
Oh, okay.
It's loo roll. What you do is you soak toilet rolls in diesel and you just line them along your impromptu runway and you set fire to them and they burn for half an hour.
Yeah,
right.
And the pilots can. Yeah. And if you can't do that, if for whatever reason you've got to the end of your last roll, maybe that's the crisis that you're calling the flying doctors for, then you have four cars with their headlights at the corners of your runway.
Just
have to put on their headlights.
Very cool.
Flying doctors.
They're awesome.
Here's one from Henry Biggs.
Mm-hmm.
Until the mid-1920s, Italians drove on both sides of the road.
Well, we all drive on both sides of the road, because that'd be a complete waste of road.
Yeah, so you mean one way.
What?
It's not like you look at a road and only half of it's being used.
Oh, we're in pedantry cul-de-sac now. They drove on the left and the right.
Okay.
In the same
direction.
Thank you.
Why did they do such a thing?
Well, Italy largely adopted driving on the right as law in 1912, but in some cities with tram networks, drivers would have to switch to driving on the left as they approached the city centre. Quite confusing. Mm-hmm.
You know what? I once drove the wrong way round a roundabout in Italy, and they were very annoyed, the people who were also on the roundabout. Mm. But I should have just said, I thought we were still in 1912.
That would have calmed it down. Yeah, but weirdly, they think the Romans drove on the left. So I looked into this a bit off the back of
Yeah, I think that's true, isn't it? So they look at the ruts in the road and stuff.
You've got it.
Yeah.
Oh. That was going to be a little quiz.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. Just forget. Okay, Dan and Anna, forget you had that.
Yeah, sure. I can't believe James doesn't even need the quiz question at this point. It just comes in with the answer.
Do we know they weren't just always reversing, though?
That's true.
Well, it was 1998 they worked out, because there was a quarry near Swindon. And archaeologists found it, and they found the ruts on the... So if I'm looking at the quarry from a distance, right? Mm-hmm. The ruts on the right-hand side of the road are deeper than the ones on the left. Mm-hmm. So what they think is that carts were arriving lighter on the left, because they're not weighed down, and then they're weighed down with stones as they're leaving, so the ruts are heavier. That's how they can tell which side of the road was driven on.
Very cool.
That's really clever. That is amazing.
It's great detective work.
One last one. Mm-hmm. From Adam Wilson, according to the leading piracy historian, Marcus Rediker, more people have worked on the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise than there were ever actual Pirates of the Caribbean. And it's partly because the number of pirates was so small. He reckons, Marcus Rediker, who is a very eminent historian, that there were 4,000 total ever, cumulative.
Gosh. Pirates.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, imagine that, like 4,000 of them, and what they have influenced. Every child pretends to be a pirate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, honestly, it's incredible. 4,000 people.
Wow. And they are pretending to be Golden Age pirates.
Yeah, they're probably not... they're pretending to be 100 of those, right? Most of them wouldn't have been army hearties.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. 4,000.
I know. And I presume the number of people who works on I presume even the graphics department for one Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah. There have been about 4,000 of the films, haven't there?
That's true. Yeah. Okay, that's it. That's all of your facts. Please keep sending them in to podcast@qi.com. We love hearing from you, and they all get read, and some of them may get read out. So that's an added incentive. So thanks to everyone who contributed to today's show. If you would like to get in contact with us about any of the things that we said, we can all be found on our various social media accounts. Dan, you're on...
at Schreiberland on Instagram.
James, you're on...
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Lovely. Anna?
You can get in touch with the podcast as a whole by going to Instagram at nosuchthingasthefish, Twitter at nosuchthing, or emailing podcast@qi.com.
And I'm at Andrew Hunter M on Twitter. And if you enjoyed this kind of show, slightly different format, we actually have a club, a secret, private, highly publicized members club. It's called Club Fish. It's so much fun. For a few quid a month, you get ad-free episodes and you get bonus content, including Drop Us a Line, which is our audience feedback bit, which is very funny. It's
not dissimilar to what you just heard.
No. The audience is funnier than the podcast.
Yeah. And it's really, you know, I think a lot of the intellectual life is happening in Club Fish at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the salon.
It's the sauna.
It's the sauna. So whip off your wedding ring, pop your gold in the safe, and step on down. That's on Patreon or Apple, and you can get that at nosuchthingasafish.com as well. And if you go to our website, nosuchthingasafish.com, you can listen to previous episodes. You can get tickets for our tour. We are going on tour around the UK, Ireland, and Australia and New Zealand. We are very excited about it. It starts soon. There are still some tickets left for some of the UK dates. Australia and New Zealand is mostly sold out at this stage.
Gothenburg, Andy?
And we're going to Gothenburg. Mm. We're going to Gothenburg for the book festival on the 27th of September. That's going to be fantastic fun. We're going to be doing a show there. So if you live in continental Europe, that's your opportunity to see us. And we'll be back again with another episode of this show next week. We'll see you then. Goodbye.